little bit disjointed because when I started preparing, the biggest thing happening in the world was the Starbucks holiday cups. If you were aware of that made-up controversy, doesn't it seem like a long time ago now? But it was only in the last week or so. If any of you aren't familiar, I will fill you in. Starbucks, the coffee chain, every year has their special holiday season paper cups for your coffee. And in previous years, the cups have featured things like evergreen trees and baubles and reindeer and words like joy and love and peace and snowflakes. This year, the Starbucks Holiday Cup is just a color pattern of what they call red ombre. Ombre just means it fades from one color into another, and so it starts near the top. It's actually quite lovely if you look at it. It starts at the top in a poppy red, and it fades down to the bottom into a holly red with the Starbucks logo on the side. And all sorts of people were up in arms, or at least claimed to be up in arms, because Starbucks was ruining their Christmas by not having snowflakes on their paper cups. Did I sum that up more or less appropriately? Now, there's been lots of discussion about whether that uproar was really about getting attention for themselves or about jumping on the bandwagon or what. But that was the biggest thing happening early in the week. And so I was all prepared to come here and spend 20 minutes talking to you about Starbucks paper cups. But then on Thursday and Friday, there were bombings and killings in Beirut and Baghdad and Paris. And if you haven't heard about that, I encourage you to look into it. I'm not going to go into a lot of detail, but the week took a different turn than I think any of us were really expecting. Jesus, in today's story, has been visiting the temple, and in the Gospel of Mark, we get the strong impression that this is the first time in his life that Jesus has been to the temple, has been to Jerusalem and seen it. And we get the impression that it's the first time in the lives of his disciples that they have been to Jerusalem to see the temple. But in order to understand what they were experiencing, the story begins, in some ways, the story begins 50 years earlier. In other ways, it begins 1,000 years earlier. Because the story of Jesus entering the temple cannot be separated from the story of the temple itself. There was not always a temple in Jerusalem. The first temple in Jerusalem was built between 800 and 900 years before today's story, by the King Solomon. At the time, King Solomon was the mightiest king in the region, and he was able to draw wealth and resources from all the surrounding territories to build this grand temple to God. It was a grand building project for the time. By our standards, it would be smaller than the building we're in now. But it was appointed with gold and with precious marble and cedar and other valuable and fragrant woods and oils. And it was glorious. It stood for 500 years, give or take. And then that territory was conquered by an empire, the Neo-Assyrian Empire, with its capital, Babylon. You don't need to remember those words, it's not on the test, but some of us like to hear the details. The Neo-Assyrian Empire conquered that territory, leveled Jerusalem, destroyed the temple, carried off all of the gold and precious stones and woods, carried off much of the population of the city as well to their capital in Babylon. And for 100 years, give or take, there was once again no temple in Jerusalem. And then that empire, as empires do, fell. The wheel turned. The Persian Empire came into power, and the Persian Empire allowed the people, now more and more known as the Jewish people, to return home and to rebuild their temple. And they did. And they built it on the same spot. They built it the same size, but it was no longer a grand building project at the time. It was small. They knew it was small. It no longer had all of the wonderful appointments of gold and fragrant woods and fine marble. It was modest. It was humble, but it was theirs. And over the following 400 years or so, I'm talking in broad strokes here, in centuries. When I say 400 years, it might be 350, it might be closer to 500, but about four centuries through that time, they were ruled by various foreign powers, Persian powers and Egyptian powers and Syrian powers and Greek powers. And then about 100 years before our story, after the fall of the empire of Alexander the Great, the people, now the Hebrew people, now the Jewish people, revolted against Greek power, and for the first time in centuries, they were their own country, they were their own people, their own nation, with their own king and their own capital. And that lasted a little while. Until the Roman Empire started to expand, and when the Roman general Pompey arrived with a show of strength, they saw how the wheel was turning, and so they welcomed him in. They got to keep the same line of kings, continued to rule for another 20 years, but they were no longer their own country, their own nation, their own people. They were now a Roman territory. And about 70 years before today's story, that line of kings, the line of kings that came to power in the revolt against Greek rule, gave way to a new king. And this is a king that I'm sure many of us have heard of, Herod the Great. Herod the Great was born in a Jewish family, an ancient and noble Jewish family. He was a member of the Jewish people, but he was in every way imaginable a Roman ruler. And he began construction projects. He moved the capital from Jerusalem to a new port on the seacoast. The Jewish people had never had a seaport. They had never had a harbor. They weren't seafaring people. And Herod the Great, with Roman power, Roman engineering, Roman money, built a harbor where there was none. Built a breakwater for shelter where there had been only barren coastline. And his new capital was moved from Jerusalem to the coast of the sea. And he began construction projects to turn Jerusalem into a true Roman city. The Roman Empire understood, in a way few or none had before, that if you can shape the way people move, the way people do commerce, the way people do worship, if you can shape the way people perceive military power, the way they perceive political power, then you can shape the way they think and the way they feel and the way they react. So Jerusalem was transformed into a Roman city laid out on a Roman plan that allowed the military and the commerce and the politics to flow in particular patterns, particular ways. 50 years before today's story. So now we're in time frames that most of us can imagine. 50 years before today's story, Herod the Great began constructing what's called his renovation of the temple in Jerusalem. This is actually, I was just noticing that the table has very similar proportions to the Jewish temple as it had been for 1,000 years. This table, if you imagine it, on the top of a hill, so that you have to walk up the hill to get to it. There's an entrance with an open area here, so this space would be flat on the ground with a wall around it. And then progressively higher steps, until encased within this portion is the holiest of holies that only the high priest may enter, and that only once every year. It was so sacred a place that when he went in there once per year, he went in with a rope tied around his ankle, so that if he fainted or died while in the presence of God, no one would have to go in to get him and profane that space by entering. And then as you progress out from that place, you have the place where the priests are allowed to be, the place where the men are allowed to be, the place where the women are allowed to be, the place where the lepers are allowed to be, the place where the alien residents are allowed to be. And all of that perched at the top of a hill. And what King Herod did was he built up that hill. He filled in the ground so that instead of a slope leading up to the temple, there was a flat plaza, like the floor here. And all of a sudden, what had been the temple became the temple. But Herod was a Roman king. Understanding that if you control how people shop, how people worship, how people think, how they relate to the military and to the government, then you control virtually everything. And so, while the temple was here, within his new building project was the marketplace. And now, the trade happens not on the hillside on the way to the temple, the trade happens within the temple court itself. And over here, not far from where this cross is standing, towering over the temple court, is the Roman military garrison, so that you could not enter the place of worship without your eye being drawn to the symbol of military power. And yet, his project of building up the Temple Mount, building the new marketplace, the new garrison, the new plaza, was one of the largest construction projects in history at that time. And 50 years later, a group of young men from the country, from the backwater of Galilee, are making their first ever trip to Jerusalem and laying eyes on the temple for the very first time. And they turn to their teacher and they say, "Look at the wonderful construction that has happened here. Look at how large the stones are. Look at how big and grand our temple is." They are impressed. They are impressed by how modern, how grand, how big. They are proud to be in a world-class city. And Jesus says, it isn't going to last. We can be blinded to the ways that we are being influenced, the ways that we are being impressed upon, the ways that forces in the world are making impressions on us. We can be blinded to the effect. Excuse me. So here's where I get disjointed. because this is the point at which I was going to start talking about Starbucks. And so my brain is telling me, now we talk about Starbucks, now we talk about Starbucks, but there's so many more important things to talk about. I don't know how many of you are active on any kind of internet social media, but I know that other generations have their own social media. What happens for me on Facebook or Twitter or the comments section of a website happens for others at the coffee shop or at the grocery store or over their kitchen table. And whatever our social network is, I expect there's been a lot of talk about what happened over the last few days in Baghdad and Beirut and Paris. And Jesus says to his followers, you will hear of wars and rumors of wars. You will hear of nations divided against each other, nations going to war. And he says, be careful, beware of anyone who tries to tell you that when that happens, it is the end. Beware of anyone who tells you that when that happens, it is me doing it. And he says, beware of anyone who tells you when that happens, that they are able to save you. He says, many will come claiming to be me, claiming that they can save you, claiming that they are the answer. But beware. Because those things, he says, are not the sign of the end, they are the sign of the beginning. One of the fascinating things for me this week, both in the non-controversy in the beginning of the week and the events of the latter part of the week, is that on my feed, on my Facebook wall, on my the people that are my friends and that I follow and whose comments I pay attention to online, no one was upset about the red Starbucks cups. And all sorts of people who I follow online were also saying that no one they follow was upset about the red Starbucks cups. But if you looked, you could find the people. And so the impression that we're getting, the information that we're getting, what impresses, what makes its impression on us, depends on who we pay attention to. And it was the same thing for me later in the week, because I saw all sorts of talk about people who, in the wake of the bombings and the killings in those three cities, were encouraging us to harden our hearts, encouraging us to become, to be harder, to be firmer, in whatever language they used, encouraging us to be closed, impenetrable, strong. But no one who I follow was saying those things, because I try to manage who gets to make an impression on me. The people that I was following were talking about, in the wake of heartbreak, making sure that we stay open-hearted, making sure that we stay compassionate, making sure that we stay generous, making sure that we realize that the refugees from Syria who are seeking places of refuge around the world are running from the same people who committed these atrocities in these other three cities. The question that Jesus is putting to his disciples is the same question that faces us. Who and what will we allow to impress us? Will we be impressed by the grand constructions? Will we be impressed by well-armed security forces? Will we be impressed by leaders who claim to be taking a strong stand? Or will we be impressed by the people who, in the face of overwhelming heartache and heartbreak and grief and loss, choose to remain open and vulnerable and compassionate? I'm trying to find my reading here. Here we go. When his followers ask Jesus how they will know that the end has come, he deflects the question. In effect, he's saying the same thing we see in the Bible in the early chapters of the book of Acts. He tells his followers that it is not for them to know the times and the seasons. It is not our job to know when something is going to happen. It's not even our job to interpret world events as to whether Jesus has come again, as some people like to talk. But here in Mark 13 and in that passage in Acts, he says, your job is to be God's open-hearted people. To look without blinking at the terrible tragedies of the world and proclaim that that is not an ending but a beginning. To respond to violence not with strength, but with compassion. To respond to horror with love. To respond to fear with peace. And to be part of the beginning that is happening around us all the time. So whether it's Starbucks ruining our Christmas, or people with anger and violence in their hearts terrorizing our friends and neighbors, we are called to the same response: compassion and peace and patience.